How on earth does a 22-year-old woman of Jewish Ukrainian heritage end up as the only woman on an all-male committee drafting Japan's post-war constitution? She wasn't a lawyer and was inexperienced in anything to do with constitutional work, and yet she managed to draft Article 24 and bring about a transformation in the lives of Japanese women by handing them full rights under the Constitution, ensuring Japan's feudal past was left well behind. Today, the late Beate Sirota Gordon is a feminist heroine amongst Japanese women. When offered the challenge, she consulted other countries' constitutions and her own experience of the greatly restricted lives of Japanese women, but the writing had to be done within 7 days. Joining me to discuss this from New York is her daughter, Nicole Gordon. Welcome to our little wireless program, Nicole. And on the blower from his home in Sydney is our expert on all matters Japanese, our old friend Roger Pulvers. Nicole, books have been written about your mum, a film made, and yet for decades she had to keep her contribution to the Constitution quiet. Why?
Well, there are several reasons. The most immediate, of course, being that it was technically top secret information that the Americans had done the draft of the Japanese Constitution. And although that doesn't mean that people did not know it, or some people did not know it, but it was forbidden to those who had worked on it to speak about it. And my mother very much respected that restriction. 50 years after the Constitution had been adopted, of course, a lot of scholarship started coming out, as often happens on an anniversary, and much of it referred to my mother's role in crafting the Constitution and in her participation as an interpreter during the negotiations between the Americans and the Japanese. And after that, and after her commanding officer spoke openly about the Constitution and it became declassified, she felt free to speak very openly about it, which she did. Another concern that she had was, having been 22 years old and a Westerner and not an attorney, she feared that her participation on the project might be used by certain elements in Japan as an argument against acceptance of the validity of the new Japanese Constitution.
Your mother was brought to Japan age of 6. Her father, a famous pianist and teacher, and worked at the Tokyo National University. So Beate's understanding of Japanese was excellent. But what did she personally observe of the pre-war lives of Japanese women, Nicole?
Well, she grew up in a European family, which was very liberal in the sense that, for example, she was permitted and, in fact, encouraged to play with Japanese children. So that although she had arrived with European sensibilities, she really became thoroughly versed in Japanese language, Japanese culture. She spoke Japanese fluently in the way that only a small child who absorbs a foreign language at a very young age can do. And as a result of that, she also observed the differences between her own household and what she saw in other Japanese children's homes. What she saw in other Japanese children's homes were mothers who walked 6 feet behind their husband, who prepared dinner for their husbands and then left the room so their husbands could spend time with their business and colleagues and friends, but the women did not eat dinner together with their husbands. She saw the distress of women who wanted divorce, who could not inherit property, who could not have custody of their children in the event of divorce, etc. And so she was very conscious of both the burdens placed on women, but also compared with the relative freedom of her own mother as a a serious pianist, as someone who considered herself as having many more rights, equal rights. I mean, one has to remember at the time the Weimar Republic Constitution, for example, was very explicit about women's rights. And then she also attended Mills College in California, an all-women's college, which had a president who was a very ardent feminist. And so all these different influences caused her to be extremely sensitive to the plight of women in Japan.
Let me quote from Article 24 to give the listener a feeling for what your mother wrote. Marriage should be based only on the mutual consent of both sexes, and it shall be maintained through mutual cooperation with the equal rights of husband and wife as a basis. With regard to choice of spouse, property rights, inheritance, choice of domicile, divorce, and other matters pertaining to marriage and the family, laws shall be enacted from the standpoint of individual dignity and the essential equality of the sexes. This is a leap of centuries in a moment.
Yes, and it's also far beyond what she knew was in the American Constitution. So, and I might also add that she wrote many, many more clauses for the Constitution that were not included because her American superior officers felt that they were too detailed for a constitution. They argued that, like the American Constitution, the Constitution should be more general, and she argued that the Japanese would not enact civil rights for women pursuant to a generalized constitution. And on the one hand, she made a leap, as you say, of great proportion, and on the other hand, it has been probably true that in Japan, the local legislatures have not made the best use of what the Constitution offers. So I think she was somewhat proved right by history. Having said that, though, it's so important to the women's rights groups in Japan, the article that my mother drafted, that they have successfully fended off any amendment to the Constitution on any subject over the last 70 years because of a fear that if any amendment is made, the next amendment will be to restrict women's rights.
Welcome back, Roger. Roger Pulvers. I understand that one colonel on the committee pointed out to her that even American women didn't have as many rights as she wanted for Japan's women. And in response, she fired back, "That wasn't hard."
That's right. Yes, Nicole mentioned the commanding officer, you did, Philip, and he was a remarkable man and largely responsible for mentoring her role in the drafting of Article 24. His name was Lieutenant Colonel Charles Cades, spelled K-A-D-E-S. He was also Jewish, also he was from New York, and he was a New Deal lawyer, so he was a bit adrift among the right-wing and in some senses fanatics who attached themselves to MacArthur, in particular another Charles named Major General Charles Willoughby, who was MacArthur's chief of intelligence and a man MacArthur called my pet fascist.
My lovable fascist, I have translated it.
Well, that's right. But my pet fascist and my lovable fascist, both of them. But I bring him up because he made personal attacks both on Beate and her father, Leo, and wrote cables with lots of false information about her. I carried on a correspondence with her for a number of years, and she specifically mentioned that she was terrified of him. So, meaning Major General Willoughby. But Lieutenant Colonel Charles Cades saw in her someone who could be very helpful, because she had just turned 22 when she arrived in the winter of 1945 in Tokyo. she had been working for the Office of War Information for Time magazine, and she was going to be a translator. And in 2 months' time, she was the only woman in the room, which is the title of the book that she published about her role in the mid-90s.
Well, if she was ruffling feathers amongst her fellow Americans, she was certainly agitating the Japanese negotiators. They must have hated it.
Yeah, I don't think so. I don't think she had much direct association with the Japanese negotiators. That was once the Constitution was drafted in February, in those 9 or 10 days in February 1946. It was presented to the Japanese government, and there was a lot of backroom argument going on, and whether this would be acceptable, and there was wide agreement that it would be okay, and it was accepted and came into effect in May 1947. But by then her role was finished, and her parents, who had been under house arrest in Karizawa, which is a resort in Nagano Prefecture in the mountains, and had suffered very badly from that.
Yes, I want to raise that with Nicole in
okay,
just a minute.
Sure.
Yeah.
They had left Japan in the spring of 1946, and she didn't spend much more time in Japan herself. So I think her role was just she found herself in this historical context, and she just stepped up to it and did the most marvelous job. You read the article; it's beautifully written, and I think it changed the life of women in Japan after the war.
This is Ellie Nell on RN, and I'm talking to Nicole Gordon and to Roger Pulvers. Before I go back to Nicole, Roger, was any of the constitutional stuff ever run past the emperor?
No, the emperor wouldn't make any decision on whether this should be accepted or not. And in fact, one of the articles specifically states that his role is just to be that he'll. It's Article 7 of the Constitution that he has the same role basically as the monarch in Britain and so on, just as a head of state. But the Prime Minister and his advisors went over it, and of course there were objections to having this kind of constitution promulgated for Japan, but there was wide acceptance of the Constitution in Japan at the time. And in general, it's been very, very popular and very, you know, and there hasn't been much controversy except about Article 9, which is the, according to which Japan renounces belligerency as an act of the state. And to give her due, Beate Shirota, from the time that she started coming back to Japan as a public figure in the mid-1990s, came out firmly that this should be kept and that Japan should not become fully militarized and have what Prime Minister Abe calls a collective self-defense. So she became a champion not only of women's rights in Japan, but a champion of the peace movement as well.
Nicole, your mother was sent to school in America, age 16, in 1939, and when war broke out, she lost all contact with your parents. What happened to them, and how did she find them?
My grandparents were sent to a kind of village arrest in Karizawa, which was a summer resort, which they knew because they had summered there. They suffered the deprivations of war and isolation, the freezing cold, the lack of sufficient food. It was not a concentration camp. My mother found them in a dramatic way, actually. She, when she got to Tokyo, and she only got involved with the army as an interpreter because she wanted to go back to Japan. She never had any idea that she would be involved in the Constitution. But she went back to Japan, and she was sitting in a hotel lobby and listening, and she heard some music played on the radio, and she recognized her father's playing, and she asked the concierge something about it, and it turned out it was a live broadcast. So my mother knew they were alive. This was after she had gone back to where she had grown up as a child and found the entire house and everything around it destroyed by the bombing of Tokyo. So there was nothing left in Tokyo that had anything to do with her childhood. So she immediately went to got a train to go to Karizawa, and in the meantime, my grandfather had learned that she was in Tokyo, and he took a train to Tokyo, and they missed each other the first time around, but they did find each other, and she was very shocked to see their condition. My grandmother was bloated from malnutrition, my grandfather was terribly thin from malnutrition, so she, with the help of her colleagues in the military, were able to bring them supplies and get them back to health. My grandfather, as you mentioned, had been a very famous pianist in Japan, had been greatly loved by the public there, but perhaps naively he thought that during the war he would not suffer because he was so well known, and he was very bitter afterwards at the way he had been treated, and left more or less permanently until 1964, when he made a return concert shortly before he died.
Now, later, we're running out of time, and I want to make a couple more points or make sure the listener understands them. In due course, she's awarded the Order of the Sacred Treasure, Nicole, which is of some significance. But of course, she regarded accolades from Japanese women as more important. But I think it's important that people realize that she had a post-war career of great significance as head of New York's Japan Society. She introduced many Japanese artists to the West. Oh, and later as director of performing arts at the Asia Society. She never stopped talent scouting, did she?
Oh, that's correct. And she traveled all over, including in Australia, I might mention, in very extreme circumstances. Now, you have to remember we're talking about the 60s and the 70s. Now we're much more used to travel and going to remote places. But in those days, getting to see some of the folk and traditional arts around the world was a very different story. And it's documented in this a new book called The Last Boat to Yokohama that just came out by Nasreen Azimi and Michelle Wasserman. It treats the subject in more detail than her own book does. But she brought all traditional, modern folk arts to the United States. She had extremely high standards and would bring only the best that she could find. This was something inculcated in her by her father, who chastised a student who said he wouldn't have to study hard when he was going on a tour of rural parts of Japan. And my grandfather said to him, "No, it's actually the opposite. You have to work harder and play even more deeply from your heart when you are communicating through your music with people who are not familiar with it." And she took that to heart and searched Asia for all the best that she could bring, and made sure, by the way, that these arts were videotaped and that scholarly monographs were created, because so many of them were dying out. And on the other end of the spectrum,
I'm afraid, I'm sorry, but we've run completely out of time, and forgive me for interrupting. Links to the books on the life of this extraordinary woman are available on our website, abc.net.au. Thank you, Nicole Gordon. Thank you, Roger Pulvers. And coming up, as promised, the fate of the Fairfax Photographic Archive. We're off again to Little Rock.